The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
In a world reclaimed from burning skies, man's best hope, John Rourke, sore and bloodied, watches a 500-year-old space shuttle return to his barren planet. But do the seeds of the new world include the spawn of evil?
We shall destroy him, destroy her, destroy them all. And then Krakowski shall return to what used to be Germany and France and Italy. He shall destroy the wild tribes. And I shall be master of this earth. Or there will be no more earth.
We can make a beginning here, or we can make the same old mistakes all over again. It's gonna be that way again, unless we stamp it out. Stamp out tyranny right now.
We must sacrifice all to stop these traitors to the new Reich! These traitors to honor! These traitors to purity! These traitors to strength!
John Rourke clashes with old world evil as his new world desperately clings to life in Survivalist number 12. The Rebellion.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Madeira Bay, Florida.
They let him keep his belt. It was the first stupid move Dale Hargis's enemies had made all night, perhaps in days, but with some luck, it could be all he needed to survive. The blindfold he was wearing fit him snugly, but he didn't need his eyes to know the boat was turning landward, throttling down. 10 minutes minimum, a quarter hour max. Beyond that point, it wouldn't matter what he tried. His hands were bound behind him, but his enemies had used a piece of nylon rope instead of handcuffs. Stupid move number two. He listened, but he didn't hear anybody outside his cabin. In addition to pure luck, he needed privacy to pull it off. The first part, anyway. Once he was on his feet, a confrontation would be unavoidable, but it was getting to his feet where every second counted. Rolling over on his back, Hargis bumped his way around until his skull made contact with the cabin bulkhead. After that, the trick was pushing with his elbows, using muscles in his back and legs. It hurt like hell as he began to work his fettered wrists across the tight swell of his buttocks. But the nylon helped a little, yielding just a millimeter here and there, when handcuffs would have simply torn his flesh. Small blessings. Hargis let his mind drift for a moment to escape the pain, his thoughts inevitably harking back to the dilemma he was facing. He had tried to work it out a dozen different ways the past 4 hours, but he still had no idea how they had tumbled to his act. He didn't want to think about a leak, but it was something he would have to deal with later. If he lived that long. So far, so good. His hands had cleared his buttocks now. The bastards had been smart enough to bind his ankles, which would make things awkward toward the end, but Hargis reckoned he could work that problem out, if he could only get that far. Right now, he felt a good deal worse than helpless, lying with his feet up in the air, his shoulders straining to the point of separation, wicked gremlins working on his lower back with red-hot tongs. He hunched his head and shoulders forward, something like an awkward sit-up to reduce the strain, but his relief was marginal at best. He had to finish now while he had the strength and will to go ahead, or it was all in vain. He let his mind drift free again, as far beyond the pain as it could go. Unfortunately, all he could think of was the meet on Calle Ocho in Miami. He had been waiting at the rendezvous point when Escalante and his men arrived.
Buenos dias. What's going on?
Empty your pockets.
What? What the hell is...
Ah! Don't fuck with me. I know you're DEA.
Wait! Somebody must have given you...
Hargis wasn't carrying ID, of course, much less a wire. It didn't matter. Somehow they had lucked into the fact that he was DEA. No matter how he scanned the past 2 months for errors on his own part, Hargis came up empty, wondering exactly what had tipped them off. It hardly mattered at the moment, but if he survived this night, the question would be top priority from Metro Dade to Washington, D.C. A leak. The more he thought about it, Hargis had to tell himself that it was possible. The kind of money they were dealing with, it stood to reason someone would be tempted. Maybe several someones. None of it would matter, though, if he didn't get his butt in gear. His shoulder sockets continued to protest, even after he had made it. But the rest was relatively simple. The first thing Hargis did was lose the blindfold, so that he could see what he was doing for the rest of it. Unfastening his belt, he drew the 2-inch buckled dagger from its hidden sheath and smiled. He kept it razor sharp, no problem, but the grip was awkward, and he balanced urgency with caution, trying not to cut himself if he could help it. The smile was back, sardonic now, as he imagined tabloid headlines and TV news teasers. Federal agent slashes wrists on drug yacht. Scandal at the DEA, film at 11. The rope fell, and Hargis rubbed his skinned wrists. He freed his ankles, then staggered to his feet on pins and needles, circulation coming back. Between stiff muscles and the rocking motion of the boat, he almost lost his balance, but he simply didn't have the luxury of falling down. If he was going, it was time. From this point on, his one advantage was surprise. If he could make it to the rail, he had a chance. As far as odds were concerned, he didn't even want to think about it. He thought about the safe deposit box that he had rented in Miami Beach, the 17 handwritten pages he had sealed inside an envelope and left there 2 days earlier. How long before his contact used the key that Hargis mailed him for emergencies? 10 days at least. No mercy there. The cavalry was on vacation. He would have to do it on his own or not at all. The cabin door wasn't equipped with locks, but no one had a reason to suspect he would be up and moving after all. He had no way of knowing whether there were guards outside, but he would have to take the chance. Each second counted now that he was on his way. He held the short push dagger with the buckle tucked into his palm, the curved double-edged blade protruding from between his second and third fingers. He would have to choose his targets wisely, but in haste. A heartbeat's hesitation would be all the time a gunner needed to cancel his ticket once and for all. His left hand closed around the doorknob, every muscle in his body tensed in preparation for the move. The sentry had been turning to face him when Hargis struck. The blade scraped on his jawbone, sliding home an inch before his earlobe. The gunner staggered, grimacing, his right hand still inside the jacket, groping for his hardware. Hargis followed up. Dale Hargis realized his slacks were warm and wet now, but he didn't stop to think about it. He took the guard's automatic, only now realizing that the two of them were all alone. Hargis hadn't even checked to see if there were any other guards, though if there were two, he couldn't have stopped both on his best day. He shifted hands, the blood-slicked dagger in his left now, with the automatic in his right. It was a Smith & Wesson Model 59, which gave him 15 rounds to play with, but he hoped to reach the deck and disembark without a fireworks show. The less attention he attracted in the next few moments, the safer he would be. He moved along the hallway, pistol cocked and ready, just in case he met someone he didn't want to see along the way. No outside view, but he could tell from the prevailing motion of the yacht that he was headed aft in the direction of the stern. Hargis spent a moment at the bottom of the stairs while he tried to reconstruct the layout of the boat from memory. A weekend bash 3 weeks ago, with a ratio of 2 hookers for each man aboard. Coming out on deck, he would be just below the wheelhouse, visible to anyone on the afterdeck. It was a running gamble once he came up from below, but it was all he had. The stairs were carpeted, soundless as Hargis made the climb. There was a window in the door, and he took full advantage of it, scanning the afterdeck for enemies. It was a challenge, with lights behind him and the night pitch black outside, but he would have to take that chance. He was out and moving toward the nearest rail, port side.
Hey!
Hargis swiveled, barely breaking stride, and saw a gunner bursting from the wheelhouse. The gunner fell. Inside the wheelhouse, startled faces pressed against the glass, with Escalante mouthing silent curses. The water wasn't cold, by any normal standards, but it still surprised him. His knife was gone, but he had kept the automatic so far, just in case it functioned after soaking in the ocean for a while. How far to shore? He didn't have a clue, but he had fixed the general direction in his mind. 100 yards, perhaps, or twice that. There was no way he could make it on a single breath, but he was counting on the darkness for his cover once he put some space between himself and Escalante's yacht. Their destination was a mystery, but he had heard enough before they left him in the cabin to surmise that they were cruising off the southern tip of Florida, intent on dropping him someplace where he wouldn't be found until the scavengers had had a chance to feed. That meant the Everglades, 1,000 different places he could hide from searchers if he made it to the swampy shore alive. His lungs were aching by the time he struggled to the surface. For a moment he was startled, fearing he had fallen in behind the yacht somehow. But then it struck him that they must have changed directions, closing in to head him off. A searchlight swept across the water, still some 20 yards away. Before he dived again, one of the gunners opened fire on some imaginary target off to starboard. The burst of parabellum slugs that killed Hargis came as a surprise and a relief. He sank without a whimper, bubbles trailing after him, mixed with blood. The predators would find him soon, but Hargis didn't care. His final thoughts had been about Miami Beach, the safe deposit box. A time bomb waiting to explode in Escalante's face. His sole regret had been that he wouldn't be there to see it blow. Graphic Audio presents Don Pendleton's Stony Man. Narrated by Terrence Azelford, with performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Jeff Baker, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Richard Roem, Ken Jackson, Jason Stiles, Elliot Dash, Andy Clements, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, Danny Gavigan, Joe Brack, Dolores King-Williams, James Lewis, Tim Getman, Eric Messner, Corey James, Elizabeth Jernigan, M.B. Van Dorn, Bobby Azelford, and Mort Shelby. Stony Man, episode number 7.
Owyhee County, Idaho, Friday, 4:02 a.m.
The Nazis never saw him coming. Mac Bolan took advantage of the early morning darkness, dressed in black, his face and hands darkened by combat cosmetics. The terrain was hilly, bristling with evergreens, the undergrowth alive with darting, rustling predators. He took his time. It wasn't far, and there was no point stepping on a rattlesnake if he could avoid it. The warrior's black suit fit like a second skin. A Desert Eagle 44 Magnum semi-auto pistol rode his hip, and a Beretta 93R was tucked beneath his left arm in a custom fast-draw rig. His lead weapon for the probe was a Heckler & Koch MP5 SD3 submachine gun, the model with a folding stock and built-on silencer. Doomsday accessories included hand grenades, garrots, a K-bar fighting knife, and something special in the satchel slung across his back. The Fourth Reich was about to get a wake-up call. As self-styled members of the Master Race, the Aryan Dominion's brown-shirt troopers left a lot to be desired. The files accumulated by investigators from the FBI and ATF revealed that most of them were dropouts, ex-cons, deviants of one kind or another. 1 in 9 had been arrested on a sex-related charge within the past 5 years. Some of them were chronic drunks, and all of them had bottomed out in life before they found a movement that provided them with opportunities to feel superior and to hate. For $30 a year, they got the pleasure of despising anyone and everyone who had dismissed them as a pack of hopeless losers through the years. The Aryan Dominion had an estimated membership of 750 nationwide, with about 50 of the hardcore haters dwelling in a rural compound north of Grandsmere, Idaho. They tilled subsistence gardens, practiced marksmanship, and churned out endless streams of racist propaganda from the print shop. If the reports from federal agencies were accurate, they also plotted crimes that ranged from robbery and counterfeiting to extortion, arson, bombing, and assassination. Of the estimated 50 residents inside the compound, only one held more than passing interest for the executioner. His name was Eddie Kirk, and he was 9 years old. As Bolan understood the problem, Eddie was the grandson of a well-known California congressman. The politician's daughter had no inkling of her husband's mental problems when she said, "I do." It took some time, 6 years in fact, before she fully understood that he was eaten up by hate for total strangers and would never change. Divorcing Eddie's father took another 18 months, with bitter charges, countercharges, and lawyers billing by the hour. Eddie's mom got custody at last, but Dad hung on to visitation rights, one weekend out of every three. 9 months ago, he disappeared with Eddie, and the search began. A senior congressman has pull in Washington, and it was no great trick to field a team of federal agents to track Lewis Howard Kirk. Uncovering hard evidence was something else, and it had taken 87 days to place the fugitive in Idaho, holed up with his good buddies from the Aryan Dominion. When the Owyhee County Sheriff's deputies and G-men made their search of Nazi Central, they came close to touching off a firefight, but they found no trace of Eddie or his father at the compound. About that time, the congressman began to make some calls. It happened that he had a close friend in the Oval Office, one who sympathized with a parent's or a grandparent's sense of frustration and loss. Strings were pulled and buttons pushed, eliciting the information that Treasury's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had a man inside the Aryan Dominion compound, leaking regular reports on weapon shipments, demolition seminars, the works. Said agent was instructed to remain alert for any sign of Lewis Howard Kirk and son, reporting back at once if they were seen. 3 days earlier, the call had come. A double bullseye, man and boy together. The FBI wanted another crack at their target, but Washington had another idea. Two birds with one stone, as it were. Payback time. The Aryan Dominion had been linked with 7 murders, 19 bombings, and at least 24 robberies from coast to coast. So far, except for the conviction of 3 Nazis and the murder of a Kansas City radio announcer, none of the reported crimes had been avenged. If it was possible to rescue Eddie Kirk and take the new wave fascists down a peg or two, so much the better. It was Boland's kind of job, and he agreed to take it on. A briefing from Hal Brignola, his justice contact, and the die was cast. Whatever happened in the next half hour, there could be no turning back. The compound was encircled by a chain-link fence with barbed wire on top, but it wasn't electrified. This information and a detailed layout of the camp had been supplied to Bolin indirectly by the ATF connection. As it happened, Treasury's informant had been chosen for a mission to Los Angeles, a volunteer, in fact, and he wouldn't be present when the hit went down. In Bolin's mind, that gave him 50 targets, more or less, and one small boy to watch for in the middle of it all. His infrared goggles turned everything greenish, but Bolin was used to the pale, washed-out landscape by now. The goggles kept his hands free and eliminated any need for flashlights that would tip off the Aryan Dominion sentries to the warrior's movement through the trees. He used a pair of insulated cutters on the wire, some cheap insurance just in case, and slipped through a 3-foot hole. No sign of sentries yet, but they were bound to be along in time. His job, if everything proceeded in accordance with the plan, would be to raise some hell, grab Eddie Kirk, and leave the camp before the Nazis had a chance to seal his exit hatch. He had the layout memorized and was headed in the direction of the CP Quonset hut, the would-be Führer's quarters. The C4 plastique charge he planted had a detonator already attached, the red light glowing to confirm that it was armed. His next stop was the motor pool, one guard. The rap on the guy's skull would keep him out of play for a time, enough for Bolin to achieve his goal. The warrior left him in the shadow of a half-ton truck. The clumps of plastique he attached to every second vehicle in line were smaller, but no less deadly. There was a chapel on the grounds, and he passed it by. If God was moved to punish these imposters, he could zap the church himself. 2 charges for the mess hall, 1 each for the generator housing and the camo hut, and he was done. Almost. The map in Boland's memory had singled out one barracks hut where Eddie Kirk allegedly resided with his father. Going in, the executioner had no idea if Eddie would resist his liberation, but he had a throwaway syringe prepared with sedatives prescribed by estimated size and weight. Boland had gambled on the barracks being left unlocked and won his bet. He saw 4 cots, 2 of them empty. Figures huddled under blankets on the other 2, one of them noticeably smaller than the other. He moved past the elder Kirk's bed. Bolin made his way to where the boy lay sleeping. Eddie moved underneath the blankets, stiffening, his eyes wide open. The executioner pressed a hand across his mouth.
Your mother sent me. She loves you very much and wants you back. You mustn't make a sound, okay?
At a shaky nod, Bolin took his hand away.
Are you from outer space?
The warrior smiled and tapped the goggles with his index finger.
No such luck. These help me see without the lights, is all.
What about my father?
He won't be coming with us, Eddie. I'm afraid we have to go right now.
They'll stop us.
They'll try, but they won't succeed. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Okay.
He thought of letting Eddie dress, but decided that they didn't have the time. A pair of sneakers and a jacket with pajamas underneath would have to do. He checked his watch and saw that they were running out of time. Before they left the barracks, Bolin dropped the empty satchel.
It's gonna get a little loud from here on in.
I'm not afraid of noise.
Good boy. Let's do it. Come on!
He kept a grip on Eddie's hand and sprinted toward the fence, 100 yards away. In front of them, a pair of startled sentries seemed to come from nowhere, packing automatic rifles, firelight etching shadows on their faces. The taller gunner spotted Bolin first, another beat passing before he recognized the boy and got a grip on what was going down. By that time, Bolin had a fix.
You!
Not bad for shooting on the run, one-handed, but they still had far to go, another 100 yards at least before they reached the hole in the fence. The warrior spotted other sentries racing toward the center of the compound now, all homing in on the flames. A bullet zinging past Bolin's ear told him that his luck had just run out. He veered hard left, behind the nearest Quonset hut, half-dragging Eddie Kirk behind him.
Are you all right?
I think so, yeah.
I need to throw them off so we can get away.
Be careful.
Right.
He poked his head around the corner. It was just a brief glimpse, but it was enough to show him three men cautiously advancing through a pall of smoke, spread out with 10 or 15 feet between them. Time to raise the ante. Two were down, the third dazed by the blast. Getting a bead was child's play.
Let's go.
Confusion in the compound helped them reach the fence without another interruption. But a lookout spotted Bolin as he followed Eddie through the gap. A spotlight blazed to life and tried to follow them, but they were in the trees before the gunner found a target. They had a lead, but that was all.
Take my hand. I've got you.
Bolin found he could move a lot faster once he lifted Eddie into a fireman's carry. It was a long mile down the mountain to his vehicle, and Bolin knew that they would never make it with a hunting party on their heels. He had to stop the trackers cold, or they were finished. 20 yards beyond a clearing, Bolin found a tree that he could climb with Eddie draped across his shoulder. He picked out a fork that offered both concealment and a fairly stable resting place. A length of nylon rope secured the boy in place.
I'm going back. I have to stop them here so we can get away, okay?
What if you don't come
back?
I'll
be back.
Okay.
Stay quiet now.
I will.
The warrior scrambled down and doubled back to reach the clearing, picking out another tree and climbing swiftly to a vantage point that let him scan the ground for 30 yards on either side. He didn't know how many guns were tracking them, but some were bound to pass this way, and any Bolin missed would be attracted to the firefight. He counted off 6 minutes, was working on the seventh when he heard them thrashing through the undergrowth, weekend warriors showing off their lack of expertise. He marked positions by the sound and estimated there were 4 or 5 approaching in a ragged skirmish line. The first one broke the tree line just in front of Bolin, eager for the kill, without a thought for any kind of ambush waiting in the dark.
Hey!
Hey! He's here! We got him!
Below the executioner and to his left, another rifle opened up. This one had the range, its owner doubtless sighting on his muzzle flash. No time to lose. He palmed a stun grenade and pulled the pin, waiting for the rifleman to stop and reload. The executioner homed on the sounds, leading with his submachine gun, prepared for any sort of trap his blinded adversary could devise on a split second's notice. His index finger kept a steady pressure on the weapon's trigger, holding it at half pull as he circled the smoky clearing, moving closer to his prey. Five minutes later, Bolin and Eddie Kirk were on their way to Mountain City, 40 miles across the border. The year-old blazer, painted primer gray and flecked with rust in places, made the ride as smooth as possible. Eddie Kirk was silent on the drive. Bolin tried to see it from the boy's perspective, dating from the separation of his parents through abduction by his father, living with the Aryan Dominion, to a night of fire and blood. It was a bust, of course. He couldn't psychoanalyze a 9-year-old, but he could feel the young boy's fear, imagine something of the pain he must be feeling. Bolin had been fully grown, a combat veteran, when his own family was torn apart by violence, and it had been difficult to cope with, even so. He only hoped that the youngster could hold it all together, find the love he needed with his mother, and try, somehow, to make sense of the waking nightmare that had jeopardized his life. The kid was still alive, and that was something, anyway. The Cactus Inn Motel in Mountain City featured satellite TV and magic finger beds that shook when you inserted quarters in a coin box mounted on the wall. The coffee shop had slot machines lined up against one wall to catch the suckers bright and early while they waited for their ham and eggs.
My mother's here?
Room 17. Just let me check it out first, will you?
Sure.
It wasn't trust, he realized, so much as weary resignation. Eddie made no move to follow Bolin as he got out of the car and walked up to the numbered door.
Eddie? Eddie? Oh, God!
A young blonde woman rushed by Bolin. The warrior made no move to stop her. Inside the room stood the congressman. Next time the man spoke on television, Bolin thought the makeup crew would have to earn their money. Pushing 55, the politician looked like he had aged another 10 years overnight.
Is everything,
Mom.
All right?
The boy's uninjured. Beyond that, I'm not qualified to say.
Of course, I understand. He'll have the finest care available.
I hope so, Congressman.
I wish there was something I could do.
Just do for Eddie and his mother.
Yes, I will. Mom. Oh, you got a call.
Say what?
A message on the telephone. Call Leo, I believe it was.
That's it?
Call Leo. Yes, I'm sure that's all he said.
Thank you.
The executioner brushed past him.
Yes?
I got your message.
Are you finished up out there?
Looks like.
Okay. We've got ourselves an unexpected situation.
Is there any other kind?
I keep my fingers crossed. The man was hoping you could pay a visit to the farm.
How soon?
We could have used you yesterday.
I'm on my way.
Reynosa, Mexico. Friday, 10 o'clock a.m.
The Chicken Hawk was on his way. Carl Lyon scanned the curving stretch of desert highway with binoculars, picking out the glint of chrome in the distance, tracking until the flash of sunlight resolved itself into a sky blue Mercedes. Figure $60,000, with the built-in extras, and you might be close. Crime pays, damn right. This morning, though, it was about to pay off in a way the Chicken Hawk didn't anticipate. His name was Augustin Cavillo, Paco to his friends, who knew him best and shared his tastes. The list included politicians, businessmen and entertainers, judges, attorneys, and law enforcement officers. When they got together for the special parties Augustin Cavillo held each month at his estate outside Reynosa, they put all their differences aside and concentrated on pursuing pleasures of the flesh. As fate, or pure dumb luck would have it, all of them were pedophiles, unable or unwilling to perform with partners much beyond the age of 12 years old. They patronized Cavillo's service in the knowledge that his inventory was reviewed each month, old items giving way to new, and they would never have to see the same faces twice. In fact, it was Cavillo's method of rotating inventory that had brought Carl Lyons to Reynosa, left him crouching in the shade of thorny Joshua trees and sipping tepid water while the desert temperature began to climb. Cavillo's private parties were repulsive in themselves, but he wasn't content with servicing the so-called cream of Mexican society. Aside from pimping children to his cronies in return for cash and favors, Augustin cleared several million dollars yearly by producing and distributing a line of kiddie porn for paying customers in the United States and Canada. A relatively recent sideline was the trafficking of kidnapped children stolen from the rural countryside of Mexico for shipment north, where certain well-heeled bits of human toxic waste paid anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 each for living, breathing toys. The FBI and INS suspected Augustin Cavillo had been moving children north through Texas and New Mexico for more than 2 years. They could only estimate the numbers based on hearsay testimony and a covert scan of Paco's many bank accounts. Conservative reports stood fast around an estimated 100 victims. Feds with more imagination hinted that the number might be double, even triple that. No matter. One child stolen from a loving home and sold like so much livestock would have been enough for lions. It was time to cancel Augustin Cavillo's ticket in the name of common decency.
I've got him. Any company?
He's clean.
All right. Let's bring it home.
The tip on Paco's whereabouts had set them back 10,000 pesos. Call it $100, give or take. It would have startled Cavillo to discover just how little he was worth. Carl Lyons made it roughly 50 cents on the pound. Dead meat. Cavillo had been staying overnight in Matamoros, but the risks were greater if they tagged him there. An extra day would see him home, and they could have some privacy at his estate. Of course, they wouldn't have the place entirely to themselves. Cavillo had his servants, bodyguards, and there were always two or three young guests in residence to keep the master occupied. Today, there should be closer to a dozen, as Cavillo had a weekend party planned for several of his richest friends. Lyons had wanted to wait another day and bag the whole bunch, but justice had turned thumbs down. It was enough to eliminate the source and thereby shut down the pipeline, however briefly. Taking out a kitty pimp was one thing. Burning up the Matamoros social register was something else. He watched the blue Mercedes, following its progress for another mile or so until the sandy foothills covered its retreat.
He's out of sight. I'm heading out.
We're on our way. Don't start the party without us.
Okay, but if I see my chance, I'm taking it.
Lyons was driving a Cadillac, new model, lightly powdered with a layer of dust that cut the desert sun's reflection off of highly polished paint and chrome. The kind of car Cavillo would expect a wealthy customer to drive. In fact, the pimp was doubtless hurrying to make himself presentable for Lyons' arrival. It wasn't every day you had a chance to deal with someone who was interested in buying stolen lives a dozen at a time. Cavillo had been gobbling the bait for 2 weeks now, and the big ex-LAPD detective could almost hear him drooling on the telephone each time they spoke. The deal that Lyons offered would have put Cavillo in a different bracket if the bastard had been paying taxes to begin with. Greed would do it every time. Lyons would have liked to do the job himself, but he knew the odds. With Paco's muscle and domestic staff, he made it 10 or 12 to 1, and while he could remember playing worse hands, none of them had been by choice. With gadgets and the politician backing him up, he had a fairly decent chance of coming out the other end alive. It was all a gamble going in. They knew the bodyguards were armed, but they were only guessing on the staff. Did Paco have a fallback option for eliminating evidence? Would there be extra muscle at the rancho, with a party coming up? Unknown. The caddy almost drove itself, and Lyons leaned across to reach the glove compartment, lifting out a sleek Beretta 92F semi-automatic with a custom silencer attached. He checked the safety, then placed the pistol on the seat beside him, easily within his reach. 5 minutes brought him to the wrought iron gates. A guard in uniform examined his caddy from behind the scrollwork. Lyons left the vehicle, stretched his legs, and walked up to the gates, all smiles.
Senor?
Chad Lewis. I believe Senator Cavillo is expecting me.
The guard frowned and stepped inside the gatehouse, checking out a clipboard, finally nodding to himself. He keyed a switch, and Lyons walked back to his rental as the gate began to roll aside. He put the Cadillac in gear and eased forward, lifting the Beretta as he pulled even with the gatehouse.
Oh, one more thing.
Yes?
So, you think he'll try to hot dog?
Carl? Paul, you're kidding, right?
Damn it.
Rosario Blancanales was riding shotgun in the tail car, wishing that they hadn't given Lyons such a lead. The plan was simple, but he knew how Lyons felt about Cavillo, any child abuser. And it would be oh so simple for the Iron Man to begin without them. 2-3 minutes either way, and it could still go straight to hell.
Let's try some speed, why don't we?
80 isn't fast enough?
I'm in a hurry.
We're getting there.
As if on cue, they came around a corner, and the foothills seemed to melt away, the desert spreading out in front of them as far as he could see. A half mile farther, an access road branched off the highway toward Cavillo's walled estate. He caught a glimpse of dust just settling on the driveway.
Gates open. Party time.
Blancanales reached under his seat and found the mini Uzi, flicking off the compact submachine gun safety with his thumb. Beside him, gadgets had an Ingram Mach-10 resting in his lap. They took it easy, passing through the open gate, both of them checking out the prostrate guard.
One down.
Let's move it.
Hey, you gonna get that?
Maybe later. The beeper was their hotline link to Stony Man, an option that was rarely used except in bona fide emergencies. What's cooking, you think?
Let's stick to one meal at a time.
Distraction at a crucial moment was enough to get you killed. The team at Stony Man would know that going in, which made the interruption that much more disturbing. Hey, check it out. Ahead of them, Lyons' Cadillac was parked in front of Cavillo's rambling hacienda. Pulling up behind him, they could see the front door standing open, like the gate. He isn't wasting any time.
Hey, suppose he does it all himself. We still get paid?
Don't worry. You'll get your 50 cents an hour, just like everybody else.
Well, that's okay then.
Moving up the steps, they had their automatic weapons ready, scanning left and right for any sign of trouble from the guards. Surprisingly, the rancho seemed deserted. I thought Cavillo had a staff.
Must all be inside. Let's check it out.
They found one of the staff inside the open doorway, limp and leaking on a priceless oriental rug. His open jacket showed an automatic in a shoulder rig, but he had been too slow to reach it when Lyons took him down.
That's two.
Which ought to leave us 9 or 10 at least.
Would you believe they're on vacation? That's upstairs. Come on!
Whoa, hang on a second.
Why?
Try this.
Three gunners suddenly materialized in a corridor on their left, two brandishing pistols, the middleman packing a stubby riot shotgun. Somehow, they had missed Lyons' entrance and his move upstairs, but there was no way they could overlook the sounds of combat emanating from the second floor. Now they were facing strangers armed with automatic weapons in the master's parlor, and in such a situation, there was only one appropriate response. They opened fire. Blancanellis flopped behind a couch that was all heavy wood and leather, feeling it absorb a shotgun blast and several rounds from someone's semi-auto pistol. Schwartz was somewhere else in the room, taking cover, hopefully. Wriggling on his knees and elbows, Blancanellis made it to the far end of the sofa, braced himself, and prepared to make his move. Schwartz's MAC-10 cleared the way. Moving clear of the cover on his knees, he found a target 15 feet away and let his Uzi do the talking. That left one, the hard case with the 12-gauge. Whatever else he might have been, the shooter wasn't yellow. With his sidekicks down, he could have run for daylight, but he stood his ground. He stepped into the open, firing from the hip. Three up, three down.
Sounds like Lyons finished up too. Let's go.
No, we're still not finished down here.
Oh, man.
Moving cautiously along the spacious corridor, they checked an empty den and dining room before they reached the kitchen. Half a dozen servants huddled in a corner there. Based on their clothing, Blancanellis made them as a butler, a chauffeur, two maids, and cooks. Both of the women were in tears, and no one showed the least desire to fight or die for Agustin Cavillo.
Satisfied?
Let's go.
All things considered, Lyons thought the probe was going better than he had any right to expect. The racket issued from downstairs told him Schwartz and Blancanellis had arrived, and they were mopping up the troops who missed him coming in. Or maybe getting mopped up on their own. No way. He knew the able warriors well enough to feel a twinge of sympathy for their opponents. Just a twinge, though. Not enough to wish the sleazy bastards well by any means. In front of him, Cavillo's last two hard men lay like broken crash test dummies in the middle of a spacious hallway, leaking blood and brains. The pair had seen him coming, pinned him down with probing fire, and tried to rush him once they had him on the spot. Bad move. Between the silencer-equipped Beretta and his big Colt Python, Lyons had them covered. Never mind that he was acting like a goddamn cowboy, coming out with two guns blazing. If it worked, you said a silent prayer of thanks and turned your mind to what came next. Cavillo. Lyons had a fix on his primary target, two doors down, a bedroom on the right. The door was closed and maybe barricaded from within, but there was no more time to waste. For all he knew, the Chicken Hawk might have a child inside the bedroom with him, or he might be slipping out the window. The big ex-cop checked both his weapons, making sure that each was fully loaded. He moved silently along the hallway, stepping over bodies in his path. The floor was solid underfoot, no creaking boards. But Lyons had to figure that Cavillo would be ready for rapping on his chamber door. The gunners would have told him if they had the situation well in hand, but as it was, no pain, no gain. The able team warrior went in low and fast, coming up beside an ornate chest of drawers. His Colt was leveled, looking and searching for a target. Cavillo took a round in the side and did a sloppy pirouette right at the balcony door.
Give up, Cavillo!
Cavillo's rounds were in no danger of hitting Lyons, but it wasn't the best situation. It was a risky business, guessing the capacity of unknown weapons. Paco might have 3 rounds left or 10. In either case, though, he was short on cover, edging out of sight in a maneuver that left one knee exposed, poking around the corner of the door jamb as a target too tempting to resist. Lyons pictured himself on the target range, lining up a shot with all the time in the world. In fact, it took him all of a second and a half, cocking the python's hammer with his thumb to minimize the trigger pull, squeezing off the shot with loving care. He tumbled out of hiding, clutching his ruined knee with one hand. The ABLE team leader emerged from cover to walk toward his target.
Whoa, whoa, Lyons. You want to watch that? Hey, you ought to call ahead. I didn't have a quarter. What's happening? Just mopping up. You need a hand?
Not this time.
Lyons stepped across the threshold to the patio and kicked Cavillo's useless pistol out of reach. He knelt beside the chicken hawk and let Cavillo see the python.
Your party's canceled, scumbag. Are the children here?
Will you let me live?
I'll think about it.
They are in the basement.
Fair enough.
As Lyons turned toward his teammate, Cavillo scrambled for his hideaway gun sheathed in an ankle holster.
You son of a...
The basement. Let's go.
Let's do it. Gadgets has a call to make.
What call is that?
We got a page. Three guesses.
All this, and I thought we'd get a coffee break at least.
You'll get enough rest when you're dead.
I guess.
All right. House this size, I've got to have a freaking telephone.
La Galite, Mediterranean Sea, Saturday, 12.07 a.m.
The Zodiac inflatable was running dark and silent, with its outboard engine muffled by a special insulated hood. The island was a jagged shadow, pitch black, with a sprinkling of stars behind it. There were faint lights showing, halfway up the seaward slope, but they weren't designed to reach the water, or the five men in their speeding boat.
Be ready.
Yakov Katzenollenbogen knew the warning was pointless, but he felt obliged to mouth the words.
I make it 90 seconds, ETA.
In 90 seconds, they would be on shore. From that point, Katz knew that damn near anything could happen, but he would have bet his life on these men in a pinch. In fact, he had already done exactly that. The raid had been a long time coming. Close to 4 years since a suitcase bomb had detonated in the cargo bay of Worldwide Airlines No. 106 above Kilkenny, Ireland. 6 weeks had been spent picking up the pieces, another 8 months passing while the President's Commission plowed through reams of testimony, scientific documents, forensic evidence. 3 months later, a sanitized report was released that blamed the Libyans, withholding any names of individuals responsible for wiping out 267 lives. All that and the indictments were the hard part, moving at the speed of sound inside a vacuum, but they finally got it done. The lucky winner was a die-hard terrorist from Tripoli named Fazir Obari. He had come a long way from his adolescent days in Black September when he helped deliver weapons for the Munich massacre. A bust for reckless driving made him miss the show, and psychiatric profiles on the guy suggested that he had been compensating for his failure ever since. The grapevine had it that he rubbed shoulders with the PLO, Jihad, and Hezbollah. Obari was a killer who made up with calculated cruelty for what he lacked in terms of conscience. These days, he was an idea man, letting young psychopaths act out his morbid fantasies. But he was still acknowledged as the best around, a terrorist who put Carlos the Jackal in the shade. And it was the indictment handed down the previous Thursday that had brought the men of Phoenix Force so far from home. But for Katz, home wasn't that far away. 2 hours, give or take, by plane to Tel Aviv. He had long since cut his ties to the Mossad, but the war was everywhere. This night it brought him to a tiny speck of land a mile off the Tunisian coast where Obari made his home away from home. Katz would have been pleased to execute the terrorist on sight, but his orders were specific: seize and hold for extradition. Rough translation, grab his ass and bring him home for trial. It was an action calculated to provoke Tunisian diplomats, but Washington was tired of bending over backward to appease mass murderers and those who sheltered them with legal technicalities. Possession was 9/10 of the law in his case, and the other 1/10 didn't count. Still, killing off Obari would have been the easy way to go. Less risk to Katz's men, for one thing, while reducing any chance of an escape. Too bad. He held the tiller with his good left hand and gripped his Uzi with the stainless steel prosthesis on his right. For the occasion, he had sprayed the custom pincer mechanism with a coat of flat black paint. No point in taking chances, after all. He made it something less than 40 seconds now and concentrated on the shoreline, counting down the numbers in his head. Gary Manning hit the rocky beach a step behind Calvin James, helping his teammate haul the Zodiac inflatable ashore. They were 150 yards due east of the Aubari dock and theoretically invisible to sentries he kept posted on the shoreline. The terrorist was paranoid, but you could hardly blame him. It was how he stayed alive. The other members of the team were all on shore now, fanning out and following their orders silently, like moving parts of a sophisticated weapon. The Canadian was paired with Rafael Enciso, jogging toward a goat track etched in weather-beaten stone. Their destination, a cliff 60 feet directly overhead. The other three would head downrange to take the pier before they closed in on Aubari's hillside villa. The Uzi Manning carried had been fitted with a silencer in preparation for the likelihood that he and Enciso would make first contact with the enemy. Officially, it didn't matter who they killed on their approach, as long as they were able to retrieve Aubari still alive and kicking for the run back to their waiting submarine. From that point on, he'd be someone else's headache, handled by the diplomats and prosecutors. It was more than he deserved. They reached the cliff, a quick flash of Enciso's penlight to confirm position, and they started up the narrow track. He made it something close to 45 degrees, and Manning was relieved that they were climbing in the dark instead of coming down. If all went well, they would remove Aubari by a different route. They had a layout of Aubari's villa from a CIA informant in the PLO. It had been 7 months since their informer visited the island, and the dozen guards in residence last spring could easily have multiplied, but they were counting on the floor plan of Aubari's house to be unchanged. Above them, two men walked towards the edge of the cliff. Enciso suddenly became a statue, Manning frozen in his shadow, index finger tightening around the Uzi's trigger. Just the patrol making their rounds. Manning and Enciso resumed their climb, and 2 minutes later, they were at the top. The guards were too far to see. The big Canadian made it something in the neighborhood of 50 feet, and definitely to their left, between his own position and the villa. There would be no circumventing these guards once they made their move.
You ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Let's go.
When Enciso moved forward, Manning followed him instinctively, their shadows separating to eliminate one bunched-up target for their enemies. There were three guards dressed in army surplus jackets, denim pants, and boots. All three were packing AK-47s, but they weren't in their hands. A rookie mistake. Now, whatever happened at the house, it would be that much easier because their enemy had three fewer guns.
It's time.
I know.
They left the corpses where they lay and proceeded toward the villa. They had drawn first blood, and it was time for more. Ironically, the only terrorist they weren't allowed to kill was the most brutal of the lot. Fazir Aubari was amused by the American attempt to frighten him. He had enjoyed the headlines, citing his indictment on 267 counts of murder, all the sound and fury in the media about the possibility of extradition and a formal trial. The running dogs of fascist Israel had to find him first, and even that wouldn't help them. Not while the Tunisian government was forced to coexist with Colonel Muammar Gaddafi as its next-door neighbor. It was totally delicious when Aubari stopped to think about it. He had read the definition of a perfect crime somewhere long years ago when he was still a student radical. Contrary to popular belief, the perfect crime wasn't a secret from the world at large. The truly perfect crime was one in which the perpetrators were identified and yet remained untouchable beyond the law. Of course, it was inaccurate to speak of revolutionary acts as crimes. There was a holy war in progress, whether the Americans and others of their ilk acknowledged it or not. It had begun in 1948 when scheming British politicians ripped the very heart from Palestine and gave it to the Zionists without so much as asking the inhabitants if they would mind. From that day to the present, there had been no peace, would be none while the dark, malignant growth of Israel still endured. In such a war, there were no innocents, no non-combatants. Anyone who didn't stand against the Zionist regime was automatically fair game, an enemy by definition. Terror was the only weapon readily available to broken men, and those who took their orders from Fazir Aubari used it well. Each incident produced the same attacks by Western journalists and diplomats, but that was all beside the point. In terrorism, there was no such thing as bad publicity.
Fazir, I hear! See to the men.
Yes.
He used another precious moment, running down the possibilities. Israelis like to play commando games, but he couldn't rule out betrayal by his so-called comrades in the struggle. Angry words with Arafat had left the two of them not speaking for the past 3 weeks, and no one with a brain would ever fully trust Abu Nidal. A major reason why the war dragged on so long had always been the childish rivalry between committed warriors of the cause. But no matter who had chosen to attack him here, the move would fail. His soldiers were the best, and he was ready to evacuate if need be on a moment's notice, starting now. It pleased some Western journalists to call him mad, but none mistook him for a fool.
Damn it.
Calvin James felt his temper rise at the burst of AK fire. They had gotten within 60 yards of the villa without incident, but one lucky bastard had managed to tip off the whole place. The other sentries responded quickly, but without organization. It must have sounded strange inside the villa, like a weird one-sided battle, but Albari would be waiting for them now. The clock was ticking, any way you sliced it.
Time to move.
David McCarter pounded past James on his left, and the ex-SEAL saw Yakov Katzenellenbogen coming up the rocky stairs behind him. He leaped across the body of a fallen Arab, blanking out the image of a dead face with the eyes wide open, staring sightlessly through space. Albari's home away from home was close enough that James could make out human silhouettes behind the flimsy curtains now, their jerky haste an indication of the combat preparations being made. From soft and silent, they had gone to heavy metal hardball in a few brief moments, but it wasn't the prospect of a fight that worried Calvin James. Their orders were specific: bring Fazir Albari back alive at any cost. From this point on, it meant that they would have to double-check each target, hold their fire if there was any doubt at all, risk everything to save a piece of human scum who should have gone down with his Black September cronies 20 years ago.
Shit!
James sighted on the sentry's muzzle flash.
Thanks. I was pinned down.
No problem.
You guys, go on ahead. I'm going to cut him off.
Wait! How do you know where he is?
I don't, but I've got a hunch.
Fair enough. Keep in touch.
James followed McCarter toward the house, wishing the open slope afforded better cover from their enemies. They were within 50 feet of their destination when it all went to hell.